The House comes to oral questions. Question number one is in the name of Todd Muller.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question to the Prime Minister. Does she agree with Auckland University School of Medicine Professor Des Gorman that not all of the 2,159 people who left managed isolation between June 9 and 16 will probably be tracked down and, quote, we have to make the assumption these people have reseeded the infection in the community?
The Right Honourable Prime Minister.
Mr. Speaker, I understand Professor Gorman is an expert in occupational health at Auckland University rather than an epidemiologist. However, of course, I acknowledge the role that he has played in the medical community. I note, though, that Auckland University infectious disease specialist Dr. Susie Wiles says the chances of
Order. I'd like to hear the answer to this, and I will say to people who are barracking from my left that this question was corrected to make it accurate by me.
Mr. Speaker, I note Auckland University infectious disease specialist Dr. Susie Wiles said the chances of someone leading to community infection after leaving an isolation facility is, quote, very low, and, quote, if people had gone on to develop symptoms, that the testing and the isolation of those around them would have kicked in as well. So we're very unlikely to see anything happen from those, and if we do, it'll be very, very minor, end quote.
To the Prime Minister, how can she say that when in the absence of testing, she can't know that none of those people had COVID-19 when they left managed isolation?
Mr. Speaker, because as most countries around the world have implemented, the 14-day isolation period is the most important thing that any country can do to manage cases coming in at the border. That is why when you pan around the world, most countries are opting for isolation and quarantine as opposed to a simple testing regime. The reason for that being, of course, Mr. Speaker, because of the different time periods at which COVID can manifest, that the early stages is the most likely stage when you shed infection, and the high rate of false negatives that can be produced. As Dr. Susie Wiles says, quote, that two-week isolation is the really important bit, not really the testing, the isolation, end quote.
To the Prime Minister, if she is so confident Professor Gorman is incorrect, why did her Minister of Health announce a ramped-up testing regime yesterday?
Mr. Speaker, again, I would dispute that I would consider that ramped up. We did that on the 9th of June was when we absolutely had a very clear expectation at the time of moving into level one that we had an expectation that the foundation principles continued to be quarantine, but that we wanted the added reassurance of testing. Mr. Speaker, I say again in this House, we were the ones that set that expectation, wanted it to be met, were assured that it had, and moved decisively when it wasn't. But Mr. Speaker, I would note in this House, we are one of the few, if not the only country in the world that has both quarantine and isolation and mandatory testing.
Prime Minister, is Otago University Professor Michael Baker correct that Nationals' criticism of her government's health response is justified because this is, and I quote, a matter of life and death?
Mr. Speaker, this is an issue we, of course, take very seriously. This is why we moved to bring in the Defence Force to ensure that our expectation of testing twice during quarantine was being met. And, of course, Mr. Speaker, that is the reason we have some of the most stringent border controls in the world. Mr. Speaker, only Australia that I can see practices the same method of using government-approved facilities, but we are the ones that are mandating testing as well.
The Honourable Chris Hipkins.
Does the Prime Minister believe that adherence to the testing regime would be more or less reliable if management of quarantine and isolation facilities was devolved to tertiary education providers who don't believe the border should have been closed in the first place, as proposed by the opposition?
Mr Speaker, the member does make a good point. Our regime demonstrates our view that this has to be very tightly controlled and managed. I have seen proposals suggesting that we essentially contract out quarantine and isolation to providers who wish to operate international education, education opportunities and manage their own isolation. We are concerned that such suggestions at this point would be irresponsible, and I make that point to the member who seemed to support that.
David Seymour.
If such a suggestion would be irresponsible, did the Prime Minister ever ask Ashley Bloomfield, those people being released early from quarantine, you're testing them, right?
Mr Speaker, that was the stated policy.
Does the Prime Minister think it acceptable that one of my constituents advised by Healthline to be tested had to wait 4 hours at the St Luke's CBAC in her electorate of Mount Albert?
No, Mr Speaker, but I would point out that yesterday we had a record more than 9,000 individuals tested. 9,000. And the positives, of course, that we had were at the border. So that does demonstrate that at that raft of testing, we may have some congestion. I don't consider that to be an acceptable wait. I am happy to follow up on the member's concern, but it does demonstrate that the suggestion from the member that we have an issue within community transmission to date in our testing is not bearing that out.
To the Prime Minister, why do we repeatedly see examples of what she says is happening in the border response on the ground actually not happening?
Mr Speaker, I refute the broad premise of that question.
Why does the Ministry of Health still not know how many of the 2,159 people who left managed isolation, whether they have received a test?
Mr Speaker, the Director General did share data that he had available today in his 1:30 press conference.
How many people have left managed isolation without a test?
Mr Speaker, the Director General would have talked today about the fact that 2,159 left from the 9th of June to the 16th of June. They were all in quarantine or managed isolation for 14 days. They all had a medical check. None of them had symptoms at departure. The majority, 1,249, have been tested.
When she said of New Zealand's contract tracing capability on 28th of April, and I quote, you'll remember, of course, the Director General pointed to his view that we have reached a gold standard, unquote. Have the events of the past week proved that this was probably nonsense?
Mr Speaker, no, I wouldn't say that that would be the case. Again, Mr Speaker, we're actually talking about individuals who have completed, and the member would do well to reflect on this. Every single person that member is talking about has spent 14 days in quarantine or managed isolation as one of the few countries in the world who mandates it at our border. And now, Mr Speaker, one of the only countries in the world I can find that requires every single person coming into the country not only to isolate but to have a test. That makes us the strictest.
Can the Prime Minister confirm that over the last 14 days there have been more than 50,000 tests undertaken in New Zealand and that there have been no reports of community transmission?
Mr Speaker, yes, in fact, Professor Michael Baker actually points out his view that the reporting of our results should differentiate between those cases that are at our border, because that is very, very different than what the member across the aisle is trying to apply is happening in New Zealand.
Can the Prime Minister confirm for the House, was it her expectation that those 2,159 people who left managed isolation would have had a test before they left?
Mr Speaker, absolutely, which is why I brought in the Defence Force.
Question number two, Todd Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. To the Prime Minister. Is it correct that on 20 May, daily COVID-19 situation reports, including the New Zealand border response sent to ministers, ended? If so, why?
Mr. Speaker, no.
To the Prime Minister. After 20 May, did she ask to regularly receive the sort of detailed information about the border, quarantine and managed isolation which she had been receiving prior to that date?
Mr. Speaker, to the best of my knowledge, the daily reporting the member is referring to is the Ministry of Health daily SITREP, which was circulated to a wide range of recipients. To assume that that was the only information received by the government and ministers is wrong. We received daily isolation reports that included information around individuals in quarantine and isolation. The COVID daily case reports, so obviously the cases that we had in New Zealand, and testing numbers. I note for the member that is also made publicly available each day. And of course, Cabinet received weekly COVID dashboards reporting on things like lab capacity, testing results, PPE and cases in New Zealand, and the number of people in managed isolation and quarantine.
To the Prime Minister, did her regular reporting include how many tests were being carried out and how many tests needed to be carried out to ensure full coverage of those in quarantine and managed isolation facilities?
Mr. Speaker, there was daily reporting on testing numbers. Mr. Speaker, at one point we did directly query the fact that our testing numbers were declining. Mr. Speaker, you'll recall yesterday in this House, for the members' edification, I talked about our office seeking information of testing at at-risk places. That prompted the Ministry of Health to reconfirm to my office on the 5th of June that daily testing was occurring for day 3 and day 12 of those at the border, including everyone at facilities, starting from the 8th of June.
Prime Minister, did her regular reporting include confirmation of people who are leaving managed isolation with testing as per her requirements of 8th of June?
Mr. Speaker, as I have said, we queried directly from the Ministry of Health what was being undertaken at the border. I note for the member, we did that before the protocol was even meant to be in place. They reconfirmed that it was occurring. If the member is trying to suggest that somehow we knew something was not happening, that is patently and factually incorrect.
So, the Prime Minister, was it a fact of the information being provided by her officials to her request for information that was incorrect?
Mr. Speaker, again, as I say, we were advised that the testing was happening twice during a period of quarantine, that anyone that came in after or before the 8th of June would be tested before leaving the facility. And of course, the Director General confirmed that in public statements made from my recollection on the 9th of June as well.
So to the Prime Minister, she's saying she has been misled by her officials. Essentially, they reported to her things that were happening that simply weren't happening on the ground.
Mr. Speaker, this is not a revelation or new information. We've consistently identified that there was a failure to act in practice on what was an expectation of the Cabinet. But, Mr. Speaker, our responsibility is to fix that problem, which we have.
To the Prime Minister, is she essentially saying that from her perspective, the government's instructions were clear? Officials had a job to do and they were left to do it without ministers asking any regular questions or receiving regular reports?
Mr. Speaker, I again reject the premise of the question. As he will have heard me say in the House yesterday, we directly again queried with the Ministry of Health the testing regime to be in place, and that of course included the border, and received a response confirming the testing we had an expectation would be happening starting from the 8th of June. Mr. Speaker, I think this is an opportunity for me to mention to the House, though, since that time we've had over 5,000 tests happening across our quarantines and managed isolation.
To the Prime Minister, does she accept that this comes down to two scenarios? Either her officials misled her or she and her ministers haven't been doing their job and not asking the right questions?
Speaker, this comes down to a scenario of the fact that we still have some of the most stringent requirements in the world. We still have cases contained at the border. And in a place, in a world where we have record COVID cases being reported daily, record cases, we are still in a position where New Zealanders should feel rightly proud of the work they did to get us here.
Question number three, Dr. Deborah Russell.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Minister of Finance. What recent reports has he seen on government initiatives to support businesses through COVID-19?
Mr. Speaker.
The Honourable Grant Robertson.
Mr. Speaker,
I'll just say that just because one member makes an unfortunate noise, it doesn't have to be repeated from the other side. Grant Robertson.
Mr. Speaker, I've seen a huge number of reports from affected business owners who have contacted the government to emphasise the difference the support measures have made to their businesses over these difficult past few months. One woman wrote to say, quote, "The wage subsidy has been a huge help to us. My husband is a self-employed builder and we would have been in serious trouble financially without it, and the mortgage holiday which we had to access as we have not long taken on a mortgage for our new house. It would have been a very worrying time for us without this help. My work has also accessed the fund and hopes to make it through, and so far there have been no job losses for us. Just one other example, Mr. Speaker, our business owner said 12 weeks ago today we received the wage subsidy to help us maintain our staffing during the tough times. I have to admit I had a lump in my throat when I explained the prospects to our staff at the end of March. You all know how the last 12 weeks have played out, so I thought it prudent to offer my sincere thanks. We are now back on our feet and have even taken on a staff member laid off from a related business."
Wow. What other reports has he seen on the impact of government initiatives to support businesses through COVID-19?
Mr. Speaker, one Canterbury business owner wrote to the government saying, "I just wanted to say a heartfelt thank you for not only offering New Zealand businesses the wage subsidy package, but also for the ease of applying and prompt payment. As a small business, without these financial assistance packages, I doubt we would have survived, and up to 17 people may have lost their jobs." A Waikato business owner said, "Without the government support provided, the business would not have survived the lockdown, and 36 staff would have lost their jobs. We're not out of the woods yet, and with a tough May, we will be relying on the wage subsidy extension to pull us through. But we are hopeful and optimistic that the company will survive. The remainder of the year will be tough, but we believe we can do it, but only thanks to the government support we received."
As of today, how significant has the government's investment to support COVID-affected businesses been?
Mr. Speaker, we continue to provide a wide range of support initiatives for businesses dealing with the fallout of COVID-19. The original wage subsidy scheme provided over $11 billion to support 1.7 million jobs. As of yesterday, the extended wage subsidy has provided just over $1 billion to 80,591 businesses, supporting 251,000 employees. In addition, the government has lent nearly $1.4 billion to 83,392 businesses under the Small Business Cash Flow Loan Scheme. Mr. Speaker, we have always been clear that the road ahead will not be easy, but that is why we are continuing to provide the support for businesses across New Zealand as they work hard to recover and rebuild over the coming months.
Great work.
Supplementary question.
Has the Minister seen Hamish Rutherford's report that New Zealand First have pulled their support for the COVID commercial rent legislation regime, and 2 months after he announced that the help was going to be on the way soon for small businesses struggling with rental costs, nothing has arrived?
Mr. Speaker, yes, I have read that report.
Question number four, the Honourable Paul Gosden.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker, to the Minister of Finance. What advice has he received, if any, on the number of jobs that could be lost over the next 3 months or 12 months if New Zealand fails to create, quote, "the world's most intelligent border," end quote, that he spoke of about on the 4th of June?
Mr. Speaker, the member is referring to a hypothetical scenario that includes a number of assumptions that could lead to a range of outcomes. The advice I have received through the main forecast in Budget 2020 assumes border restrictions are not fully lifted until April 2021. Of course, the government is continuing to work to be able to safely and progressively lift border restrictions as and when it is safe to do so. In terms of the impact on the number of jobs, as I said yesterday, advice on job losses and creation is continuing to evolve. The advice I have received in the Treasury's main budget forecast is for the number of people in employment to in fact rise by 14,000 over the next 3 months, that being between the second and third quarters of 2020.
Has the Treasury advised him that failing to test people before being released from quarantine does not in any way, shape or form represent the world's most intelligent border?
Mr Speaker, in terms of specific advice, no.
Does he accept that opening up our borders safely to get Kiwis trading again, to import skilled migrants, tourists and international students is critical to saving jobs?
Well, Mr Speaker, I believe that ensuring that our border works well and that our border restrictions are put in place are incredibly important, and I invite the member to remind his leader of that as he makes promises to various sectors to open the border up.
So how will Kiwis working in the tourism, hospitality and international education sector keep their jobs if their fellow Kiwis aren't confident that this government can be trusted to open the border safely?
Well, Mr Speaker, I believe that actually the New Zealand public have a lot of confidence in the way this government has managed and handled COVID-19. And I remind the member that, on this side of the House, we have taken these decisions seriously and carefully. We haven't undertaken knee-jerk reactions. We haven't done things that would have seen us in a situation that we see across the Tasman, where we see infections rising again and actual community transmission, not the imagination of the Leader of the Opposition.
Has anyone advised him that while his government's ambition is for the world's most intelligent border, the reality sadly resembles much more Kiwi build and the light rail down Dominion Road?
Mr Speaker, no. The advice that I continue to receive is that New Zealand, compared to most countries in the world, finds itself in an incredibly privileged position where our economy is largely back operating, where we're able to move freely around, where we do not have community transmission. That is the actual facts of the situation.
Question number five, the Honourable Michael Wilkins.
Thank you, Mr Speaker. My question is to the Minister of Housing. What examples, if any, is she aware of where people in managed isolation have mixed with other guests at the facility during their 14-day stay?
Mr Speaker.
The Honourable Chris Hipkins.
Mr Speaker, on behalf of the Minister of Housing, like that member, I've seen media reports of returnees mixing with other returnees. Returnees are given clear guidance about the rules for keeping 2 metres distance from other guests, and prominent signage reaffirms this throughout facilities. There is an element of personal responsibility expected from returnees to adhere to those rules. We've introduced an additional layer of assurance with day 3 and day 12 testing, as well as lockdown procedures when a case is confirmed, which includes reviewing CCTV footage. It's important to remember that during Alert Level 4, when COVID-19 was in the community, many of us continued to go grocery shopping where we came near other people, so it's important that we don't fearmonger regarding this. Putting that aside, what we've seen hasn't been good enough, and that's why we have brought in the New Zealand Defence Force to manage these operations. I take any concerns about mixing in these facilities seriously, and I'll continue to relay my clear expectations that there is strict adherence to the rules. If any member has credible information about mixing, they should supply it and it will be followed up.
Given that answer to the Minister, given that answer, why is it that when a COVID-positive test occurs in a managed isolation facility, the whole facility goes into lockdown?
Mr Speaker, there are a number of things that need to happen, including cleaning, for example. Very, very strict protocols have been put in place to ensure that where there is a positive test, the appropriate steps are taken to ensure that it doesn't spread to anybody else.
Has she been made aware of a birthday party that took place in a managed isolation facility, bringing multiple people together who should have been isolating separately?
Mr Speaker, I did see that report on the media. I can confirm that there were no homeless people at that event.
The Honourable Grant Robertson.
Supplementary question to the member. In light of that question and answer, can the Minister provide any examples, or in fact has he been provided with any evidence of homeless people mingling with others in managed isolation? Yeah.
Mr. Speaker, I have seen allegations that a homeless person was housed in quarantine for 2 weeks. That report has been rigorously followed up, devoting a significant amount of officials' time. It has thus far proven to be nothing more than an urban myth.
To the Minister, in respect of that answer, if it was such an urban myth, why did the government spend, quote, hundreds of thousands of dollars investigating it?
Because, Mr. Speaker, on this side of the House, we believe members of Parliament should be taken at their word.
No, you don't.
Order.
We'll take two.
To the Minister, has she been made aware that the Chief Ombudsman had to cancel a prison inspection because the staff doing it found out they were mixing with people supposed to be in managed isolation?
Mr. Speaker, I think the Chief Ombudsman's comments on this are of public record. Those comments were made at least a week ago.
The Honourable Grant Robertson.
Has she received a response to the letter that she wrote to the Honourable Michael Woodhouse asking him for evidence of his claim of a homeless man joining a managed isolation group?
Mr. Speaker, on behalf of the Minister, I'm advised that no such evidence has been forthcoming.
To the Minister, is the reason that testing is now so important because she has no confidence that people are isolating effectively within the isolation facilities?
Mr. Speaker, no, testing is important because it gives everybody confidence that people leaving managed isolation will not have COVID-19.
Question number six, Angie Warren-Clark.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Associate Minister of Health and asks, what recent announcements has she made regarding funding for our health and disability system?
The Honourable Jenny Salisa.
Mr. Speaker, this coalition government is lifting the support available to New Zealanders with disabilities with the largest funding boost for disability support services ever. As part of Budget 2020, the government is investing an additional $833 million over 5 years to ensure people with disabilities are part of an inclusive recovery for our team of 5 million. This government is committed to the well-being of all New Zealanders, and this follows on from the funding increase for disability support services in Budget 2018 of $211 million and an increase of $348 million in 2019. I'm proud to be part of a government that puts people at the heart of its decisions.
Supplementary. What support will the additional funding provide to disabled New Zealanders?
Mr. Speaker, this funding will ensure we keep up with the rightful expectations of the disabled community to live good lives as other New Zealanders do. Disability Support Services provides access to much needed support for personal care. This increased funding is to ensure better access to support for showering and hands-on care, and it includes accommodation for disabled people with high needs, equipment for mobility and access, and respite for whānau carers, as well as rehabilitation for people following a serious illness. We've also invested an additional $12 million towards transforming the disability support system so that disabled people and families have greater choice and better control over the services that they access.
Supplementary. What feedback has the government received on this boost in funding?
Mr. Speaker, this funding boost has been well received by the community, who agree that it is well overdue. Dr. Garth Benny, Chief Executive of the Disability Support Network, and I quote, said that the budget has lifted support for the disability community to record levels. This will make a real difference in people's lives after years of funding falling behind the cost of delivering disability support services. Mr. Speaker, we know there are many outstanding issues in the disability sector to address. However, this is a monumental step forward in the right direction in terms of the services and support for disabled New Zealanders.
Question number seven, the Honourable Judith Collins.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Speaker. To the Minister for Economic Development, does he stand by his statement yesterday in the House, quote, construction projects are an important part of the government's response to the recession caused by COVID-19, end quote. If so, when will projects identified by the Infrastructure Industry Reference Group that he announced with the Minister of Infrastructure be announced?
The Honourable Phil Twyford.
Mr Speaker, to the first part of the question, yes. And as the member identified in her question, the announcement she referred to was made with the Minister for Infrastructure, who, along with the Minister of Finance, are the ministers responsible. These ministers will make announcements in due course.
Does he agree with Auckland Mayor Phil Goff when he said, quote, "We want and expect the government to decide as soon as possible the projects that will be included in the shovel-ready programme, end quote. If so, when will the government announce them?"
Well, I don't think it's a matter of agreeing with the Mayor of Auckland on that statement that he made. He made the statement. It's up for him to stand by it.
Then how does he rationalise publicly urging Waikato councils to invest in infrastructure alongside the government in order to develop the economy when he has yet to publicly commit to any of the projects identified by the Infrastructure Industry Reference Group?
Well, as I've explained to the member now multiple times, it's not for me to agree with projects that were identified by the Industry Reference Group. That's a matter for the Minister of Finance and the Minister for Infrastructure.
Then why did the Minister have his name on the press release?
Because I and the Minister for Infrastructure were tasked with commissioning the Industry Reference Group to solicit those projects. That's why the press statement was released.
Is he saying that despite announcing as Minister of Economic Development the process to select infrastructure projects, that he now has no say in those decisions?
As I've said repeatedly, the decisions on those projects are being made by the Minister of Finance and the Minister of Infrastructure.
Question number 8, Kira Tavu Allen.
Mr Speaker, my question is to the Minister of Agriculture. What action has the government taken to support jobs in the dairy sector?
Mr Speaker, this government recognises how important our dairy sector is to our economic well-being, and we're backing it for the long term. Mr Speaker, we want to connect people with the rewarding life in the dairy sector and more broadly the primary industries. Today we've announced that we've joined with DairyNZ to give a $3.5 million boost to their Go Dairy initiative. This is a program that has successfully recruited and supported people into careers for the past 15 years, Mr Speaker. We're happy to support DairyNZ and this initiative.
Supplementary, Sim. How does this work fit in with the wider government employment strategy?
Mr Speaker, this complements the work being done to place 10,000 New Zealanders into primary sector jobs by rapid retraining and absorbing workers displaced from other sectors. Mr Speaker, we've committed $19.3 million as part of the $1.6 billion trades and apprenticeships training package. We've also got, as part of our $1.1 billion commitment, to create 11,000 jobs in the regions that will help many of the farmers across dairy and other sectors, Mr Speaker. We've got a $100 million worker redeployment package that will create other opportunities. Mr Speaker, the primary sector is a wonderful place to have a career, and we're helping New Zealanders move into that space.
Supplementary, sir. How has the government worked with the sector to inform the support?
Mr Speaker, we have regularly engaged with industry groups at both agency and ministerial level. Mr Speaker, I know that many good MPs on this side of the House have been out talking to farmers to get feedback. Part of the process has been to reassess how we currently approach attracting people into the sector and ensuring that our training programs are fit for purpose in the current environment. Mr Speaker, it has included a collaborative consultation process. We have made some adjustments to ensure that, firstly, we have focused marketing to get to the right people, effective training to lift their skills, and rewarding career opportunities.
Question number 9, Chris Bishop.
Thank you, Mr Speaker, to the Minister of Transport. Does he stand by his statement, quote, "One of my first actions as Minister will be to have officials advised on how quickly we can start and how soon we can get it built. I would expect Queen Street to Mount Roskill within 4 years as a minimum. If we can do it faster, we will. And when does he expect construction to begin on Auckland Light Rail?"
Honourable Phil Clifford.
Mr Speaker, yes, in the context it was made. I expect a timeline for the start of construction will be outlined by the government after the election. After considers options developed by Treasury and the Ministry of Transport.
What are the reasons for Auckland Light Rail not progressing until allegedly after the election?
Because the three parties of government were unable to agree on the way forward.
Has he seen the statement from the Green Party this morning, Green Party welcomes new approach to delivery of light rail, and does he agree with it?
Yes, I have seen the statement, and I agree that the Cabinet's move to delegate the progress of the project to the Ministry of Transport and Treasury will allow a public sector-led approach. It will allow more engagement and collaboration with stakeholders like Auckland Council and Auckland Transport.
Order. Before the member comes on, I know that Nicola Willis has recently moved closer to my hearing, but I do want to warn her that she's not allowed to make noises while her colleague is asking questions. Chris Bishop.
What were the estimated costs of the NZ Infra and NZTA proposals for Auckland Light Rail?
Those costs are still subject to commercial probity, so I'm unable to release that information at this time.
Okay.
Julianne Genter, the Honourable Julianne Genter.
Can he confirm that Auckland Light Rail City Centre to Mangere is a priority confirmed by all parties in this government in both the Government Policy Statement on Transport Funding and the Auckland Transport Alignment Project, and that work will now be continued by the public service, including the local authorities in Auckland?
Yes, I can confirm all parts of that question.
Has he received advice about whether the Crown will have to pay compensation to NZ Infra as a result of today's announcement on light rail?
Yes, I have.
What does that advice say?
We do not.
Question number 10, Dr. Liz Craig.
Mr. Speaker, my question is to the Minister of Health and asks, what recent action has the government taken to strengthen our COVID-19 testing and to protect New Zealanders from the virus?
The Honourable David Clark.
Mr. Speaker, this week, on behalf of the government, I announced a renewed COVID-19 testing strategy. Under this government's leadership, the Ministry of Health, ESR, DHB's frontline health staff, scientists and lab workers stood up a COVID-19 testing program in short order that has served us well to date. It was a key tool in eliminating community transmission of the virus, and with over 350,000 tests done to date, we have the highest rate of tests per confirmed COVID-19 case in the world. But the COVID-19 pandemic is getting worse elsewhere in the world. Clearly, the greatest risk for us now is the thousands of New Zealanders coming home from global hotspots. So our new testing strategy will focus on our border while maintaining surveillance of our communities for any sign of the virus.
Supplementary. How will this new strategy keep New Zealanders safe?
Mr. Speaker, most of the international travellers arriving on our shores right now are New Zealanders returning home. The vast majority of them will be COVID-19 free. Nevertheless, we need to be able to welcome them back confident they won't inadvertently reintroduce the virus into our communities. That's why we'll continue to test new arrivals on or around days 3 and 12 of their stay in managed isolation and quarantine, and a negative result is required from the day 12 test before people are allowed to leave. We also need to minimise the risk that those who come into contact with them during their travel, their arrival and during their managed isolation or quarantine do not contract the virus. And if they do, that we quickly detect the infection and take appropriate action. Our new testing strategy features regular health check and asymptomatic testing of all border-facing workers and regular testing of quarantine-exempt people such as New Zealand-based aircrew.
So does the focus on our border mean we're scaling back testing in the wider community?
Mr. Speaker, absolutely not. Today, a record 9,174 tests were carried out. Across the wider community, we will continue to test all close contacts of confirmed or probable cases. Testing will continue to be available for anyone presenting to primary or secondary care with any type of COVID-19 symptom. And to ensure our surveillance testing is appropriate and equitable for New Zealanders, no matter who they are or where they live, DHBs are now required to regularly review and take action to increase testing in population groups if there is significant variation to the national average in their region. Mr. Speaker, this government is prioritising the safety of New Zealanders with our testing approach. We're adapting this testing strategy where required, and we are making sure it has the resources to do the job with an additional $89 million in funding for the next 6 months.
Question number 11, Jenny Marcroft.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Minister of Defence and asks, what recent announcements has he made regarding the replacement of the C-130 Hercules fleet?
The Honourable Ron Mann.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Mr. Speaker, on 5th of June, I was proud to announce that the Coalition Government had approved the long overdue purchase of 5 new Lockheed Martin C-130J Super Hercules transport aircraft. Generations of New Zealanders have grown up and, in my case, grown old, Mr. Speaker, with the 1960s era Hercules. They know these aircraft have always been an essential first line of response at home and in the Pacific during natural disasters, times of crisis, and in support of our military operations around the world. The new aircraft will fly further, faster, with a greater payload, Minister of Finance, and than the current Hercs. And the $1.5 billion project will also deliver a flight simulator and supporting infrastructure.
Supplementary, how do our new Super Hercules compare to others in service around the world?
Speaker, they compare very well, Mr. Speaker. Actually, each aircraft will be fitted with additional specialist capabilities outside of their standard build, including wide bandwidth, high-speed satellite communication systems and electro-optical infrared cameras. This equipment will make our new Super Hercs amongst the most capable in the world. The satellite communication systems will allow imagery, video and data to be streamed in real time, and the camera allows for the conduct of aerial surveillance operations at the same time that the aircraft is undertaking transport missions, which will be particularly useful in HADAR and search and rescue operations.
Supplementary. How does this decision complement other Air Force capability decisions made by the Coalition Government this term?
Mr. Speaker, some people in the Defence Force are now describing this period as the golden years for defence procurement, starting with and stating that in one short term we have effectively revamped the major capabilities of the entire New Zealand Air Force. In addition to the Super Hercs, Mr. Speaker, this government has procured 4 new P-8 Poseidon maritime patrol aircraft, purchased a new simulator for the NH-90 helicopters being installed right now, signed a contract for the lease of 4 new King Air 350Bs, about 150 mil, with 2 fitted specifically for maritime surveillance.
Order.
There's a lot
order,
more, Mr.
Order.
Speaker.
Yeah, well, none of which is a recent announcement. Even the 5th of June hardly qualified.
So many questions for you. Could I ask the Minister, what possible excuse has he got that we've had to wait all these years to modernise essential military and humanitarian equipment?
It's not his responsibility.
Order.
A point of order, the Honourable Dr. David Clark.
Point of order, Mr. Speaker, I seek leave to correct an answer that I have given to question 10 today.
Is there any objection to that? There appears to be none.
Mr. Speaker, a colleague has drawn attention to the fact that I said in my answer that today a record 9,174 tests had been carried out. In fact, that was yesterday that a record was set. Today we do not have the results in yet.
Going back to the point of order, because I cut him off.
Speaker, is that Mr. Mark would have explained that it's taken him 2.5 years to get to the point where he wanted to get to, or he could just plainly say that his useless predecessors didn't do their job. But either way, it's in order.
Order. The member is the most experienced member of the House, and he knows that donkey drops to bash the opposition with are not allowed by way of supplementary question.
Question number 12, Simon O'Connor.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Minister of Customs. What steps has she taken, if any, to ensure customs staff are prepared for the increase of New Zealanders returning home?
Mr Speaker.
The Honourable Jenny Solicitor.
Mr Speaker, that's a really good question from the member, and I can confirm that I have worked constantly with Customs to ensure they have adequate resources in place, which enables them to facilitate any increasing numbers of international passengers arriving at the border, while continuing to perform their important border protection functions. I've also sought assurance that Customs is continuing with its best practice health and safety measures to ensure New Zealand Customs staff are protected while working at the border. Mr Speaker, I believe the results speak for themselves. Since the 3rd of February, when the first border restrictions measures were implemented, 521,381 people have returned from overseas to New Zealand. To date, there has not been one single confirmed case of COVID-19 with any of our customs staff. However, if any issues are brought to light, they will be investigated and addressed immediately.
How can she share all of that with confidence when little under 5 days ago an OIA obtained from her office has revealed that staff in customs have undertaken absolutely no new training to prepare for these changes?
Mr Speaker, what I can say is that customs officers, from the very beginning, we've had public health officials actually walk through and ensure that our customs staff know how to actually wear PPE. Customs maintains physical distancing, and the use of masks and gloves is something that customs do. Mr Speaker, as I say, the result speaks for itself. None of the customs staff have been tested, have actually COVID-19 positive. They have been tested, though. Mr Speaker, there's also been high participation of customs officers for volunteering for testing. One of the things that customs has done is it's redeployed a lot of its staff to ensure that they also help out with contact tracing. Mr Speaker, as I say, the result of customs not having any COVID-19 cases, Mr Speaker, is one thing that we can look to in terms of their adherence with PPE and with health and safety measures.
Does the Minister not appreciate that training of customs staff is not simply for their health and safety, but for the health and safety of the thousands coming through our border and the 5 million New Zealanders here already?
Absolutely appreciate that customs staff, one of their first and foremost tasks is to ensure that the borders are secure, Mr Speaker. And they actually have done that. In terms of how they work, Mr Speaker, customs staff at the moment, as soon as international passengers get off of the international planes, they are escorted by customs staff and police right through now to 8 places where there are health officials. Now, health officials ask all of these detailed questions for all of the symptoms, and if there are any folks as they come through that exhibit symptoms, they are then referred to public health nurses, Mr Speaker. There is actually a really rigorous process at the international airport, Mr Speaker. Then what happens is there are 2 places. So for those that actually have any symptoms, they go through one place where they do not mix with other passengers. And then they go out a different door, Mr Speaker, straight to a shuttle and straight to quarantine. Mr Speaker, I say this because I myself, as Minister of Customs,
Order. I'm getting cries of enough from my left, so I think we'll leave it there. That concludes oral questions.